This is November 5th, 2004. I studied the book of Isaiah on chapter 16. Arthur Eggers. Send ye the lamb to the ruler of the land, from Selah to the wilderness, unto the mountain of the daughters of Zion. This chapter, God is offering mercy to at the coming of the Messiah to deliver his people. We have this takes us clear down to the end time. This prophecy is, and we want to remember that all these prophecies have two fulfillments. There's a partial fulfillment at the time of Isaiah, and or later, another fulfillment in the last days. In verse 1, the Lamb will be a tribute to Jerusalem. It's called the ruler of the land, as they once paid to Israel as a tribute. Let's look in 2 Kings chapter 3, and we'll see the time, or the first fulfillment of this. Verse 4. And Mesa, king of Moab, was a sheepmaster, rendered unto the kings of Israel 100,000 rams with the wool. So Selah is a place in Edom of the children of Esau to be used for an offering to Jehovah. And so they, in doing so, they, when Christ takes his place, they represent the nations, the other nations. Anybody that isn't an Israelite is a heathen, and is considered so at this time. And so the Selah is a place in Edom. The meaning of the name is a rock or a fortress. So also the thought is also given to Judah as a rock. But the tribute will go to Mount Zion for the purpose of offering sacrifices there. In verse 2, he has gone up to Bajeth and to Dibon, the high places, to weep. Moab shall howl over Nebo and over Medeba. On all their heads shall be baldness and every beard cut off. Now God is taking care of Moab. We see here I read the wrong verse, didn't I? I read in 15. I thought something was wrong here. Let's go back to 16, chapter, verse 2. And it shall be that as a wandering bird cast out of the nest, so the daughters of Moab shall be at the forts of Arnon. When we think about this, we think of how God will take care of Moab. Moab at that time then will be as a wandering bird or a helpless bird that fell out of a nest and won't be any strength or of her own whatsoever. And no longer will they be protected by anyone else. And when the northern armies come down to the, especially to the forts of Arnon, and this is a place on the river that's easy to cross, that the northern borders, to cross the northern borders of Moab into the land. And so there they will be absolutely helpless, and no one's going to help them. And so they will make some changes here. They'll need some help from God. Then in verse 3 it says, take counsel, execute judgment, make the shadow of the night in the midst of the noonday. Hide the outcast. Betray not him that wandereth. There are five things in verse 3 to do when this army comes, when judgment comes upon them. And one is they will take counsel, or they will come together and discern what they need to do. The only answer to their problem is to recognize the God of Israel. It's the only thing they can do. The second one is to execute judgment, and how good it is when people learn to judge themselves. They'll take counsel, and then they'll learn to execute judgment concerning the counsel that they take. They realize the position they're in, and they need to judge the situation. Then the third one is to make their shadow as the night, and mist of the noonday. Shadow has no substance. There's nothing there to help. God has no shadow of turning. He's stable. I think there's a thought of that in here, of unstableness. The fourth one is to hide the outcast or a refugees. They'll need a refuge during the tribulation time. Christ is the only defense anyone's going to have. And when they realize this fact that Christ is the only help, then they'll find a place in Him. They'll find a refuge in Him, a place to flee. And then the next one is, betray not him that wondereth. Not to reveal or to disgrace of them that flee. And they will flee to the mountains. When the enemy comes down, Israel will flee to the mountains and hide. But when the Lord comes to help Israel, then the foreign nations will flee to hide from him. Now we have this in the book of Revelation. They'll flee to the mountains and cry upon the rocks and the hills to fall upon them. And it'll be a sad situation for them. But then Israel went through this same thing too when judgment came upon them. In Matthew 24:16, Jesus told Israel that those that be in Judea, flee into the mountains, and the remnant will be cared for in the mountains for 3.5 years, or 42 months, or 1,260 days. We find that in Revelation 12, where God is going to protect Israel during the time of siege that will come upon them. In verse 13 of Revelation 12, and when the dragon saw that he was cast into the earth, he persecuted the woman. Now this woman is the remnant of Israel that God will miraculously take care of, which brought forth the man-child. And to the woman were given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness and to a place where she is nourished for a time and a half time. So time is a year, times is plural is 2 years, and a half time is a half a year, or 3.5 years from the face of the serpent. And the serpent, and then we read 16, and the earth will help the woman, and the earth opened up her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast. And God is going to take care of her in such a wonderful way. Well, when Jesus comes and they flee from the face of him, then there's only one place for them to go, and that's repent and turn to him. The word betray there in verse 3 is to strip or to put on shame. Captives are usually stripped and march with very little clothes on. And who? Well, those that flee to hide will be brought down to absolutely nothing. Then in verse 4, let mine outcasts dwell with thee. Moab, be thou a covert to them from the face of the spoiler, and the extortioner is at an end. The spoiler ceased, the oppressors are consumed out of the land. So notice whose outcasts these are now that we're talking about in verse 4. Mine outcasts. These are God's outcasts. These are his people that we're talking about here. The remnant of Israel. And they'll tell you a time when they will hide with the Moabites from the enemy that will come down from the north to destroy them. But God will protect them all. They'll protect the Moabites for the Jew's sake. We have a scripture in 1 Samuel 22 that's so fitting along this line in a picture of this. When David was fleeing from Saul, and in verse 3, we read there that David went to Mizpah of Moab, and he said unto the king of Moab, let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you until I know what God will have for me. Now, he's a beautiful picture here of the remnant of Israel that will flee, and the Moabites will know that it's of God. The tribulation will not last forever. It will come to an end. And God is not going to annihilate the whole nation, not in any way. He's going to keep his king. He's going to keep his people. And then in verse 5, we read, And in mercy shall the throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth, in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment and hastening righteousness. Now, this is the throne of David that we see being set up. So it's a throne of mercy, and Christ will be the king on that throne, but it'll be the same as the throne of David. It'll be the seat of David. And Jesus Christ will establish his throne and will judge in truth as the seat of David. And we read the genealogy in Matthew chapter 1 and also in the 4th chapter of Luke, how that Jesus is the king in the lineage of David that will sit upon the throne, fulfilling the Davidic covenant of 2 Samuel 7, and maybe we should read that along this line. Let's turn over to 2 Samuel 7 and read verse 24, I believe it is, verse 12. 2 Samuel 7, 12. Now this is called the Davidic covenant. And when thy days be fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, talking to David, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and will establish his kingdom. And he shall build an house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom. How long? Forever. It's an everlasting kingdom. Well, this wasn't in David, and it wasn't in Solomon, was it? I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chastise him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. And somebody might say, well, this couldn't be Jesus because he never committed iniquity. But he did commit iniquity. And you know when? On the cross. As he died there on the cross, he took our sin in his own body there. Now, in verse 6 of this, we have heard of the pride of Moab. Now, this is a problem of most people, is pride. It's a terrible thing, isn't it? Pride of Moab, he is very proud, even of his haughtiness and his pride and his wrath, but his lies shall not be so. Now, this is the reason for God's judgment upon Moab. And as I said before, he is a representative of anyone that don't know Christ as their Savior. And the old creation is proud. We're this from nature. And we read in Proverbs 16, verse 18. And most of us know this scripture. It says that pride goeth before destruction and haughtiness before the fall. There has to be a fall. There has to be destruction to pride and haughtiness. Then there's another verse in Jeremiah that we should read along this line. It's in Jeremiah 48, and I'm going to read verse 29. Here's the pride of Moab spoken up here. We have heard the pride of Moab. Oh, Jeremiah did too? Yes. Isaiah and Jeremiah both. We have heard the pride of Moab. He is exceedingly proud. His loftiness and his arrogancy and his pride and the haughtiness of his heart. See, all of these things is the works of the old creation. If we would read in the fifth chapter of Galatians, we see the works of the flesh in verse 20:19. Said, now the works of the flesh are manifested, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulsions. And this word emulsions is simply pride and jealousy, wrath, strife, seditions, heresy, envy, murder, drunkenness, reviling, and such like. And so all of these are the things of the flesh, and there's no good thing of the flesh. They're all evil. And we read in Romans 3 a list of the indictment against the whole human flesh, whole new human race. And 3:10, I believe it is, says, as it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth, there is none that seeketh after God. They're all gone out of the way. They're all together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. So of the Adam nature, of the Adam, descendants of Adam, I'll put it that way, there is not one good person. How do we get good? By being born again, by becoming a child of God, by letting Christ have his place in our life. Here is 13 on down through 18 is the indictment against everyone. And their throat is an open sepulcher. With their tongue they have used deceit. Poison of a snake is under their lips. The mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet is swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery is in their way. And the way of peace have they not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now, all of these is attributed to the old creation, the flesh, the descendants of Adam. And so there's only one way of escape, and that's to know Jesus. Pride will destroy people's life, and there's no hope for them. In verse 7, therefore, because of their pride, because of their haughtiness, therefore shall Moab howl for Moab, for themselves. Every one shall howl, for the foundation of Kir Hareseth shall ye mourn. Surely they are stricken. Therefore, the anguish will overcome them. The word Kir, and I'm not sure about the pronunciation of that word, Hareseth, I think that's the way it's pronounced. We have it again. We haven't had it before in chapter 5, verse 11. In the end time now, all these nations that we've been talking about will come down, and their purpose will be to destroy. The enemy, our enemy, the devil, would like to destroy, annihilate, I'll say, the nation Israel. And you know why? You know why he's so interested in annihilating Israel? Because if it were possible, God couldn't be God anymore. You know why? Because he gave Abraham a promise. And any time God can't keep a promise, he's not God. And so he has to have at least a remnant of Israel. So when these nations come down, their purpose is to annihilate. And we read here in Daniel, at the end time, Daniel 11, I'm going to read, 40 and 41. And at the time of the end, see, this tells us what we're talking about, the time of the end. This is not the first fulfillment of Isaiah, but the last fulfillment of what we're reading in Isaiah. Every prophecy has two fulfillments. I mentioned this earlier. There's a partial fulfillment, and this shows that the prophet is telling the truth. There's a latter fulfillment that will completely take care of the prophecy that has been made. And so the last fulfillment of this will be in the last day. And so it says, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the country and shall overflow and pass over. And he shall enter into the glorious land. Now the glorious land is the land of Israel, and the land that God promised them. And many countries shall be overthrown. So not only will the promised land that God has promised Israel, the glorious land, but many countries along with that be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. Now, Edom is from Esau, Jacob's brother, and Moab And Ammon is from Lot. They're illegitimate children of Lot. And God is going to outstretch his hand, make special effort to take care of them because of Abraham's sake, because of Lot's sake. And when the armies of the north come, their anger will be against Israel, but all these surrounding countries will suffer because of it. Then in verse 8, we read that in our lesson, for the fields of Heshbon languish, and the vines of Sibmah, the lords of the heathen, hath broken down the principal plants thereof. And they are come even to Jazer. They wandered through the wilderness. Her branches are stretched out. They are gone over the sea. Heshbon was a city given to the Reubenites. So you can see the connection here. They were of Moab. See, Reuben, Gad, and a half-tribe of Manasseh camped on the east side of Jordan. They never went over into the promised land themselves. But Heshbon, and I'm not going to take time to go over, but you study this out in the book of Joshua, it was one of the Levitical cities. And what we're talking about, the Levitical city, was a city that the priests live in. And the lords of the heathen that we read of here are all the Gentile powers of the last days, and they'll be everywhere. They'll just come down like a swarm of bees. They'll just be everywhere. See, her branches stretch out, and they're going over the seas, wherever. They're just stretched out everywhere. Verse 9, therefore, or because of this, I will bewail with a weeping of Jazer, the vine of Sibmah. I will water thee with my tears, O Heshbon and Elah, for the shout of the summer fruits and for the harvest is fallen. Now this is similar to 15:5 that we read, and I'm not going to read it again, but Jazer was a place that was given to Gad. And so it was Reuben, Gad, and a half-tribe of Manasseh that camp. So this was given to Gad. And this also was a Levitical city. The wine that we read of, wine always speaks of joy in the scripture. It's not necessarily God's joy, but it's natural joy. Sometimes it's false joy even. But the thought here, I think, is the wine of Sibmah is gone. They have no joy. They have no even false joy, no temporary joy. Isaiah is a beautiful picture here of the remnant of Israel, and his tears is to be the only joy these people will have, to know that they do have somebody that cares, somebody. And in verse 10 then, we go on, and the gladness is taken away, and joy out of the plentiful field, and in the vineyard there shall be no singing, neither shall there be shouting. The traitors shall tread out no wine. The treaders shall tread out no wine in their presses. I have made their vintage shouting to cease. No gladness, no joy, no singing, no shouting, no rejoicing. And oh, how they used to shout and for joy when they had plentiful grapes. When they could come ripe, they would have a big feast and just shout. But no more. Why? Because God has taken it all away from them. It surely pays to be submissive and obedient to God, because God's judgment is harsh. In verse 11, read, wherefore my bowels shall sound like a harp for Moab, and mine inward parts for Kir-Hashrus. This is the third time that we read of Isaiah showing his feelings for even an enemy. I was thinking about this earlier. This area that he was weeping over was east of Jordan, even east of the Dead Sea. And even today, these people that dwell there are the enemy of Israel. And yet, God's going to have a people that will weep for them and pray for them. There's a verse in Matthew 5, verse 44. And here's what Jesus said about this time. He said, "But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, and do good to them that hate you, and pray for them that despitefully use you, and persecute you." And this is the same thing, as I said before, Isaiah here is a picture of the end time remnant. And they will weep for their enemies because Christ is going to want them to do that. They will feel sorry for the nations that will go into judgment. And Kirhashris is the wall. The meaning of this word means the wall is earthland. And when you think of the meaning of that name here, you think of a protection that is easily broken. And that's the way the nations will be, especially those that are round about Jerusalem, around about that area over there. East of, and right now, they're fighting, they're killing the Palestinians. This is part of that area. And the Golan Heights and their army, they're arguing and bickering and fighting. But the remnant is praying. And we should pray for those that do that, that despitefully use you. We read last night in the sixth chapter of Ephesians that we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against wicked spirits in high places. People are not our enemy. Let's don't blame people for situations. We have a powerful enemy that's superhuman. Yeah, I think it's wonderful here that Isaiah would pray for them as a type of a remnant that will cry out to God even for their enemy. In verse 12, reading, "It shall come to pass when it is seen that Moab is weary on the high places and shall come into his sanctuary to pray, but he shall not prevail." And you wonder why? Because this is not Jehovah's sanctuary. This is his own sanctuary. You know, people don't want to trust the Lord until they have to sometimes. They'll trust everything. They'll trust doctors. They'll trust lawyers. They'll trust everybody and everything. And when everybody fails them and there's nothing left, then they'll trust the Lord. And so Moab and these are not quite ready to do that yet. They go to their own high places where their own idols are. But when they do that, there's no answer. And we don't need not wonder why, do we? We know that God doesn't answer when we're seeking help from somebody else. Verse 13, "This is the word that the Lord hath spoken concerning Moab since that time." Jehovah has this to say. This is his word that he's saying. And he's spoken it before, and he's saying it again. God has a future purpose for all nations. In Isaiah 11, let's go back there just a minute, and verse 14, I believe it is. Yeah, verse 14. "And they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west." Now these nations at this time is going to help Israel. "They shall spoil them of the east together. They shall lay their hands upon Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon," these are the ones that we've been talking about, "is going to come under their authority. They're going to obey them." And there was a time that God would have destroyed them, but he's not going to for Israel's sake. Verse 14, I guess. "But now the Lord has spoken, saying, within 3 years, as the years of a hireling, and the glory of Moab shall be contemned, and all the great multitude, and the remnant shall be very small and feeble." Phrase, "but now." So now we're coming down to this. Another word that God has a set time that he's going to do with this. And what is the years of a hireling, we might say? Well, if one hires another, He expects him to work certain hours. He doesn't leave early off the job, and he doesn't work late. He works, you're hired on a job to work 8 hours a day. Your boss expects you to work 8 hours a day. So the time of a hireling is a time of expectation to work. So God's time is exact, and he's not going to change. At the very end of the tribulation, which he has set up, he has a time for all things. In Galatians 4, verse 4, we read, "And when the fullness of time was come, God sent his own Son in the likeness of flesh, born of a woman, born under the law," read there, "the likeness of flesh, condemned sin in the flesh." And so there was a time, exact split second, for Jesus to be born. So is it to the end time. God has a split second for Jesus to come back. He has a time for Jesus to set up a kingdom on earth. He has a time for him to catch away his people to heaven. He has everything is according to God's plan. And we read in Ephesians that this plan was set up before the foundation of the world. Think about that. Before the world was ever set up, before anything that was made, God began all things with a plan. And so the first thing he created was time. And then he starts setting up things. And he has an exact time for all these things to happen. And personally, I believe we're living in a time for him to come back for the church, to catch believers away, and then 7 hard, terrible years of tribulation will enter in. All right, let's go into chapter 17, and we read of the burden of Damascus in chapter 17. And so let's turn our attention to Damascus. And the word Damascus means silent is the sackcloth weaver. Now, sackcloth was a harsh, rugged cloth that was real cheap. I imagine it's something like what we would have gunny sacks made out of. We don't have gunny sacks much anymore. When I was a kid, they had a lot of them. But it was a cheap cloth, and it was used mostly for mourning. And they would lay in sackcloth and ashes to weep and to mourn. So Damascus was to be broken down and be silent. It'd be a silent place. Now, the name Damascus goes all the way back to the 14th chapter of Genesis. And I'm not going to read that. You can write it down and read it later, verses 14 and 15. But when Abraham heard that Lot, his nephew, actually, I think it calls him brother there, was in trouble, that he had been taken captive by an armed nations that had come down. It was 3 nations, I believe it was, if I remember right. Anyway, he armed his trained servants. Now, these weren't warriors. These weren't trained armies. They were trained servants. And they were born in Abraham's house. But he took 318 of them, and he went after these nations that had taken Lot captive. And he went after them, and he pursued them all the way to Hobah. Now, this is on the left side of Damascus, right up there where we're talking about. And Abraham stood still, and he fought for Lot. And when these 3 kings of the north attacked where Lot lived, Abraham chased them and went with them all the way from the lower part of the Dead Sea all the way up to Damascus. And he captured them. Now, only the power of God could have done that. It was impossible, absolutely impossible, for Abraham to take a group. He had enough of them, but they weren't trained to fight. They were servants. And he went up there and whipped 3 nations. Now, we're going to see a deliverance like that, a miraculous deliverance of Abraham's descendants one of these days. And at this time that we're reading here, Syria had conquered the 10 tribes and were in great power. And when Assyria fell, the 10 tribes suffered with them because they had been taken in to be a part of them. So they all suffered together. We had Syria and Ephraim, then they became confederates together against Judah, and they being closely linked together in council, read here, and we read the story of that in 2 Kings 16, and I'm not going to turn to it, but you write it down and you study that and read it. It's a beautiful, it's a time of defeat of the 10 tribes and the confederacy, the council, as we read here, that they'll have together. So read the 2 Kings 16, 5 and 2 Chronicles 28, 5 and 6 along this line of what we're seeing. The burden of Damascus, behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap. Now this was the head of the Assyrian government and how powerful they were. But when God says he's going to destroy the tool that he whipped his people with, then they're destined to be destroyed. In verse 2, we have the cities of Arah are forsaken. Now, we don't know exactly where this is, but it was a city that was given to Gad on the east side of Jordan. And we have two main powers of the, we had two main powers of the 10 tribes. Ephraim represented Israel on the west side of Jordan, and Ur represented the 10 tribes on the east side of Jordan. And all of this included Syria will be a heap of rubbish brought down to nothing. Now, let us bring this down to today and look at the conditions in this very area. Because a lot of God's people, a lot of theologians, I'll put it that way, have placed Arah as being in the area that we know the Golan Heights. And the thing that there has been, and the arguing and bickering over this area. And Jacob, and I think now, Laban. Laban was a Syrian, and they made a contract in the book of Genesis, and in our break I said that we would look back over to this area that we're talking about, and there was agreement between Laban and Jacob right here where we're talking in the 31st chapter of Genesis. I want to read verse 24. He called Laban the Assyrian, and then also earlier than that, but we read in verse 17 that Jacob arose and he took all of his goods. And in verse 18, we read, he went to Padan-Aram, which is to go to Isaac his father in the land of Canaan. And he crossed the river Euphrates in verse 21. And he set his face toward Mount Gilead. Now Mount Gilead was on the east side of River Jordan. And so they came down, crossed the Euphrates River, and came down, and just right in that area is a chart that we've been fussing over of the Golan Heights. And so I wanted to read there that they made a agreement, that they made a covenant, verse 44. Now therefore come, and let us make a covenant, I and thou, and let it be for a witness between me and thee. And Jacob took a stone and set it for a pillar. And they made a covenant between Laban the Syrian and Jacob the of Abraham. And so this covenant, and it's what I had in mind when I got off kind of off on of my subject here, but the covenant, it don't seem like Syria today and Israel remember the covenant that was made between Laban and Jacob. But that was a definite covenant. And it should be honored today as well as then. That Syrians would be on the north side of the Euphrates and Israel would have the south side of the Euphrates. But it doesn't seem like they recognize that today. So we look at the land below Damascus is a part that we're talking about. And in verse 2 and 3, Ur was given to Gad. And God gave it to him, and that area belongs to God's people. It doesn't belong to Syria anymore. It would never belong to theirs. They came down and conquered it in many, many years ago, but it never really belonged to them. They're trying to say it does, and many people think it does. But all of this includes Syria will be a heap of rubbish one of these days. All right, verse 4, and it shall be, and it shall, I can't even read. And in that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall be lean. And it shall be as when the harvest man gathers the corn, and the reapers the ears with his arms, and he shall be as he that gathereth ears in the valley of Rephaim. And the thought that we have is listed in as in that day. Now we know what day. This is the last days. And we can see the glory of Israel increasing. They are respected because God has not forgotten them. They belong to him. But this will not last long, for again will go their glory and food like the harvest in the valley of giants. Actually, that's the way they should read. Rephaim was a valley of giants. And in verse 6, we see that their enemy will get the most, but the God's remnant will have just enough to live by. Where they should have been gathered in carts or in wagons, they were gathering in their arms. So they're not getting a lot out of their harvest. Then in verse 7 and 8, at that day shall a man look to his maker, and his eyes shall have respect to the Holy One of Israel. And he shall not look to the altar, the work of his hands, neither shall he respect which his fingers have made, neither the groves or the images. In that day, again, the eyes of man, that word man is the same as we have for Adam, or the descendants of Adam. And in Zechariah 9, we have a thought similar to this. In the first verse of Zechariah 9, it says, the burden of the word of the Lord, and in the land of Hadrach and Damascus shall be the rest thereof. And when the eyes of man, here's Adam again, as of all the tribes of Israel shall be toward the Lord. So their eyes is going to shift toward the Lord of glory. We had a picture of this in the Mount of Transfiguration as Jesus was a type there in Matthew 17, and we all know the story, how he was transfigured and they saw his glory. And we also have another type of this in Saul of Tarsus in Acts 9, his conversion, how God will change, will break them down, cast them down just like he did Saul, and make him see the glory of Christ. He's going to make a change. And in that day, forsaking God makes God forsake them. But forgetting God brings a dry and terrible, barren life. It pays to not forget God in life, that they may work hard, but little fruit of their labor. But we read here that Jehovah is a source of deliverance and the rock, the way of life. From this, it seems that God is doing giving them his strength. Anything other than Christ is a strange sip, a vine or branch that has been cut off. Though it's grafted into a different kind of a plant, is a thought that we have there, a strange plant, different kind, a strange slip. Verse 11, again we have the phrase, in that day shalt thou make thy plant to grow, and in the morning shalt thou make thy seed to flourish. But in the harvest shall be a heap in the day of grief and of desperate sorrow. And how terrible this will be in that day. This reminds us of Galatians 6, verse 7, Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. He that soweth to the flesh will reap of the flesh, he'll reap corruption. He that soweth to the Spirit will the Spirit reap life everlasting. As people sow, that's what they're going to reap. And if we sow the wrong seed, well, we'll just get the wrong thing. And that's true for us today in life. If we don't sow the right seed, we're going to, if you sow corn, you're not going to get wheat. And so it is with them there. In verse 12, we read that there's a woe unto the multitude of many people, which make a noise like the noise of the sea, and unto the rushing of nations, and to make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. So the word woe here could also translate, hark, the armies are coming. So many of the sounds like the roaring of the mighty sea. I've never heard the wheels of chariots running, but I can imagine that they're loud. But I've also never heard the wheels of mighty guns and mighty airplanes and mighty weather war equipment that come down, and how awful the sound must be when they come in like that. When I was in the service during World War II, we'd be attacked by planes, but I never saw it, but I heard terrible noises, and it was terrible when all the guns would go off at the same time. But here we have a description of that, like the roaring seas. And Jeremiah gave a description of this in the 6th chapter of Jeremiah, verses 22 and 23. And he says, thus saith the Lord, behold, a people cometh from the north country. Now this is the last days, from the north country. That's north of Jerusalem, with a great nation, and shall rise from the sides of the earth, and they shall lay hold on bow and spears. They are cruel and have no mercy. Their voice roars like a sea, and they ride upon horses. If this is so terrible a sound, how much more terrible it'll be when artillery comes in great armies down through there. How great it'll be when all of these war equipment come down from the north. It's going to happen again. Again, I want to say it's going to happen after the church is gone. We'll be in heaven. We'll be in glory with the Lord by that time. But it's coming. There's going to be a great array of men of war coming down against Israel and against the nations that are round about them. And this will include the Palestinians, and all of those are going to be affected by all this. They don't know it today because they don't know the word, but it's coming nevertheless. In verse 13, the nations shall rush like the rushing of many waters, but God shall rebuke them. Oh, he's good at rebuking waters, isn't he? And they shall flee off, for they shall flee far off, and shall be chased as the chaff of the mountain before the wind, and like the rolling things before the whirlwind. Now, when they harvest the grain, they would take it and throw it up in the air, and the wind would blow all the chaff away, the things that they didn't want, and leave the bare grain. So he uses this as a description of these nations. And we have a verse in the 93rd Psalm, verse 2. He says, thy throne is established of old. Thou art everlasting. The floods have lifted, O Lord, the floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lift up their waves. The Lord on high is mightier than the noise of many waters. Oh, how great God is. No matter what, God is greater. And this is what they have, and saints, this is what we have to realize, that no matter how things look, never look at circumstances. No matter how things look, our God is greater than the noise of this world and the noise of the things that surround us. Greater is he that's in you than he that's in the world, John said. And so we must realize that no matter how great these armies are that coming down against Israel, our God is greater and he's going to take care of it. But they're not going to see that, and they're going to be in terrible dismay because they don't know how to trust the Lord. Now, God will have a remnant that will know. They'll be able to do that. Notice in verse 13, but the nations shall rush. But see, God the nations can go just so far. That's all he can do. He can't go beyond God's plan. And Satan is held back by the power of God, just like he was in Job's life. Satan could just go so far with Job, couldn't he? He said, all right, you can do this, this, but you can't take his life. And so he can't with us. He can just go so far. If you're being attacked by the enemy, just remember, God has a plan of escape for you. You go through trials, and so it will be with Israel in the last days. Read of the fleeing of his power there like a chaff that has no value. The mountains here in this verse speak of nations, and the winds speak of spirits that will blow away all the rough things, all the chaff that has of no value to him at all. So these kingdoms that we read that'll come down will be worthless because the Spirit of God will move them into destruction. They may be powerful for a while, but when Israel comes to the place that they'll cry out to God and seek his face, then Jesus will come and chase the armies away. And behold, the eventide trouble. Oh, what does eventide mean? It's just before the dawn, isn't it? Just before the morning. Just before the light breaks. Eventide trouble. And before the morning, he is not. For it is a portion of them that spoil us, and the lot of them that rob us. So before these things happen, God's going to be there on the spot. And how quick things change, saints. How quick things change. One evening, they're in trouble. The next morning, these armies don't even exist. And you know, this is the way it is with us. Sometimes we feel like this is our last day on the earth, and then God takes care of our problem, and it's all gone. It just never existed. And this is their portion. This is their lot. It will happen. One more verse, and we'll end this chapter. And I want us to look at Isaiah 37, verse 36. And we read in there that the angel of the Lord went forth and smote the camp of the Assyrians, 165,000 that God killed of the enemy. And this is kind of smiley. This is kind of funny. It says, and when they rose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. I didn't know there was any other kind of corpse but a dead one. But he wanted to emphasize this fact, that God took care of the problem, and he's going to take care of the problem again.